Luke chapter 16. Jesus told his disciples, "There was a rich man whose manager was accused of wasting his possessions. So he called him in and asked him, 'What is this I hear about you? Give an account of your management, because you cannot be manager any longer.' The manager said to himself, 'What shall I do now? My master is taking away my job. I'm not strong enough to dig, and I'm ashamed to beg. I know what I'll do so that when I lose my job here, people will welcome me into their houses.' So he called in each one of his master's debtors. He asked the first, 'How much do you owe my master?' 800 gallons of olive oil, he replied. The manager told him, 'Take your bill, sit down quickly, and make it 400. Then he asked the second, 'And how much do you owe?' 1,000 bushels of wheat, he replied. He told him, 'Take your bill and make it 800. The master commended the dishonest manager because he had acted shrewdly. For the people of this world are more shrewd in dealing with their own kind than are people of the light. I tell you, use worldly wealth to gain friends for yourselves, so that when it is gone, you will be welcomed into eternal dwellings. Whoever can be trusted with very little can also be trusted with much. And whoever is dishonest with very little will also be dishonest with much. So if you have not been trustworthy in handling worldly wealth, who will trust you with true riches? And if you have not been trustworthy with someone else's property, who will give you property of your own? No servant can serve two masters. Either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve both God and money."
Well, I think it would be safe to say that this is probably one of the least known of the parables that Jesus told, and probably one of the strangest parables that Jesus told. It's the story about a dishonest businessman, and Jesus says to his disciples, "You can learn a thing or two from this man." I think it would also be safe to say that it's caused a fair bit of confusion among Bible commentators. They're not really sure what to do with it. It sounds like Jesus is holding up a crook and saying, "You should be like him." I mean, when your kids are growing up, you want them to adopt good role models, don't you? I mean, because let's face it, there's plenty of bad role models out there in the public eye. Sport seems to contain an extraordinary number of them. Let me give you a couple. I mean, if your son had this picture up on his wall, James Tarmo, I'm not sure if you know the story, we're all breathing a big sigh of relief that he's going to be able to play in State of Origin number 3, the drink driving charge without a licence. He didn't actually go to jail for that. And they weren't sure if he had gone to jail, whether or not they'd be able to get him out on a day release program to be able to play in the State of Origin. I mean, I'm sure he's a lovely guy, don't get me wrong, but not really the role model that you want for your kids. Or here's another one. You probably know this one, holding up seven fingers for the seven Tour de France wins that he had as a drug cheat. He's now been stripped of all of those seven. He'd have to hold up no fingers now because he doesn't have any Tour de France titles. They're not the sort of people that you want your kids to model themselves on. Or let's move to the world of business. If you have a son or a daughter doing a business degree, economics or commerce, you'd be worried if they had Alan Bond or Christopher Skase as their role models, wouldn't you? That if they were saying they were aspiring to be more like these two men, it would be a cause of concern. And that's the strange thing about this parable. Jesus takes a clearly dishonest man and says to his disciples, "You should be like him." You're expecting him to say, "Whatever you do, don't be like him." But Jesus says that we can learn a thing or two from this man. But I think we can actually remove the confusion from the parable. What Jesus is saying is actually quite straightforward. Now, the parable is found at the beginning of Luke chapter 16, but have a quick look back in chapter 15, a better known parable, in fact, probably one of the best known parables that Jesus told, the parable of the prodigal son, about the son who decides that he's going to waste his father's money. Now, that parable was told to the crowd generally and to the Pharisees specifically. But now when we get to chapter 16, did you see what it says? Jesus tells this parable to his disciples. Now, let's run through the parable to make sure we've got the story right. There's a wealthy man. He employed a man as his accountant or his business manager. And this guy has been wasting his boss's possessions. It's exactly the same word that was used about the son in the previous parable. Both of them were wasting the possessions. Now, it's pretty important to note that while he may have wasted the boss's possessions, it's not an arrestable offence, but it's certainly a sackable offence. At this point, he's not being accused of being dishonest with the boss's money. He's just being accused of being really bad at his job. He's wasted a lot of the boss's money. So then the boss calls him in. And you see it there in verse 2. He calls the man in and says, "I'm hearing some pretty bad reports about you and your work. It's time for you to tidy up the books and clear out your desk because you're finished. You can't stay working for me any longer." And did you notice that the accountant doesn't try to plead his innocence? He doesn't say the boss has got it all wrong. He doesn't say those rumours aren't true. He knows that he's guilty of wasting the boss's money. He knows that he's been caught, and he knows that he has to take what's coming to him. But can you imagine what it would have been like to walk into that boss's office and then to walk back out of that boss's office? I'm guessing that in the days and the weeks that led up to walking into the boss's office, he'd barely given a thought to his future. I might have looked at a few brochures, taking a cruise on the Mediterranean for his next holiday, possibly. But he'd probably given no thought whatsoever to his future. But as he's walking out of the boss's door, his future is all that he can think about. What in the world is he going to do? How is he going to live? It's highly unlikely that he's going to be able to get another job as a bookkeeper in the area. That rumour will be getting around very quickly that he's been sacked. And it's unlikely that he's going to be able to get a letter of reference or recommendation from his present boss. I love the thoughts that start flooding through his head. You see it there in verse 3. The manager said to himself, "What shall I do? My master is taking away my job. I'm not strong enough to dig and I'm ashamed to beg." They're the two options that go through his head. I could probably get a job dig. No, I couldn't do that. I'm not strong enough to be able to dig. And how embarrassing would it be to sit on street corners and have to beg for money? And then he comes up with a brilliant solution. Verse 4. Got to note the words here very carefully. "I know what I'll do so that when I lose my job here, people will welcome me into their houses." People will welcome me into their houses. That's a phrase that's going to get repeated a little bit later on in the parable. Those words in verse 4, we need to note them carefully. His plan is to enable himself to be welcomed into the homes of others when his job comes to an end. Do you see what he's going to do? He's now using the situation that he is in now and the finances available to him now to build relationships that will last until after he is sacked. He's using the situation that he's in now, the finances available to him now, to build relationships that will last after he is sacked. He's going to do one final piece of creative accounting while he tidies up the books for his boss. The plan's pretty simple, but also quite ingenious. He calls in the people who owe his boss money. He gets them to tell him how much they owe the boss, and then he seriously reduces the debt that these people have. Have a look at it. Pick it up in verse number 5. So he called in each one of his master's debtors. He asked the first, "How much do you owe my master?" 800 gallons of olive oil, he replied. The manager told him, "Take your bill, sit down quickly, and make it 400. Second man, "How much do you owe?" 1,000 bushels of wheat, he replied. He told him, "Take your bill, make it 800. Can you see the way that this is going to work? He's using his boss's resources to endear himself to these people. He's winning friends for himself, using the boss's money and slashing their debts. Now let's be clear, what the manager is doing now is wrong. We've been told before that he was wasteful. Well, now he's clearly being dishonest. But that's the surprise in the story, because look at what it says in verse 8 when the master finds out. The master commended the dishonest, or quite literally the unrighteous, manager because he had acted shrewdly, or wisely is a better way of translating it. The boss is commending this manager for what he's done. Now, the boss, let's be clear, is seriously out of pocket in all of this. But he praises this man for the way that he's handled the situation. He can appreciate how clever this was, how wise he was, how shrewd he was. He can appreciate that he's acted with an eye to the future. Now, I said before that this has caused a little bit of confusion for some of the Bible commentators. They're not sure what to do with it, and they think that you can't really take this story on face value. Jesus couldn't possibly be saying that a dishonest man is someone that we should copy. And in order to get Jesus out of what they see as being a sticky situation, they come up with very creative ways of interpreting this parable. Some people say that what the man is doing is actually reducing the accounts by unlawful interest, that what the boss was doing was actually unlawful. He'd imposed interest on there, and this manager's just being honest and removing the interest from there. But the passage doesn't say anything remotely like that. It never mentions interest, and it removes very different amounts from the two men that we hear about. Some people have suggested that he's actually doing the boss a favour because he's getting all of those accounts that were probably never going to be paid, and he's at least getting a little bit of money back for the boss, that he's actually being helpful in his final act of accounting, that he's getting 50 cents in the dollar back or 80 cents in the dollar back for his boss. But he hasn't actually collected any money. He's only reduced what these people owe. Let there be no mistake about it. The steward is being dishonest. He's cheating his boss out of what he rightfully owed him. But it's not the dishonesty that Jesus wants us to focus on. That's not the characteristic that we're supposed to copy. That's not what the boss is commending him for either. That's not why Jesus is telling the story. He commends him for his shrewdness, for acting wisely. Look at verse 8 again. The master commended the dishonest or unrighteous manager because he had acted wisely. That's a better translation of that word. So what was so shrewd or wise? Well, it's pretty simple, isn't it? He's got limited time to act. He's acting with an eye to his future, and he's using the resources available to him in order to make sure of his future. Now, many of the misunderstandings about this parable, I think, actually get cleared up in the next few things that Jesus says. It's almost as if Jesus anticipates that there will be misunderstandings, so he goes and adds a few more things after the parable to try and clarify what he's saying. Pick it up in verse number 10 and look at what Jesus says. "Whoever can be trusted with very little can also be trusted with much. And whoever is dishonest with very little will also be dishonest with much. So, if you have not been trustworthy in handling worldly wealth, who will trust you with true riches? And if you have not been trustworthy with someone else's property, who will give you property of your own?" So it's almost as if Jesus knew people are going to get very confused by holding up a dishonest person and saying there's a characteristic here that you need to copy. He's wanting in these next few verses to say, it's not the dishonesty. That's not the bit that I want you to copy. In fact, I want you as my followers to be trustworthy people. You need to make sure that you are handling your money wisely and in a trustworthy manner. And if someone has entrusted a small amount of money to you, be trustworthy with what's been given to you. But he also says another interesting thing about money, doesn't he? Verse 13. No servant can serve two masters. Either he will hate the one and love the other, or he'll be devoted to one and despise the other. You cannot serve both God and money. Now you put those two things together, the money that you have, the income that you have, in a sense is really just a trust from God, isn't it? God has enabled you to have it, so the question is, are you handling it in a trustworthy manner? Are you serving your money, or are you using your money to serve God? What attitude are you going to have towards your money? Will it be your number one priority in life? Will it be the most important thing that you strive for? Will it be the measure of success for you in your life? Or will your relationship with God be your highest priority? Because I think Jesus is saying you have to pick. You can't have both. Now again, we have to be careful. Jesus never criticises or never says that you can't have wealth. He just says you can't serve it. You can't make it your priority. There are plenty of wealthy, godly men in the pages of the Bible, and there are plenty of wealthy, godly men living today. Money's not the issue. It's the attitude that you have towards your money that's the issue. But the big lesson in all of this, the big lesson from the parable is this. Use what you have with heaven in mind. In fact, you don't have to guess what Jesus is saying in this parable. It's actually right there in verse number 9. He actually gives you the little summary verse for the parable. I tell you, use worldly wealth to gain friends for yourself so that when it is gone, you will be welcomed into eternal dwellings. The man, the accountant in the business, he just wanted to be welcomed into earthly homes. But Jesus is saying, let's make this an eternal principle, that we use what we have now with an eye towards heaven. What was it that the manager did that was so shrewd? Well, he acted with an eye to his future. And Jesus says that like that man, you need to live with your ultimate future in mind. You need to use the earthly resources that you have with heaven in mind. As we said last week, the day will come when Jesus will return. And that ought to impact the way that we view things. It means that we shouldn't just be thinking about this life. We should be thinking how we can make friends for eternal life, is what Jesus is saying. In the parable, it took the radical shock of being sacked for this man to start thinking about his future. And it sometimes happens like that in our lives, doesn't it? It can be the radical thing that will happen that will make us reassess our priorities and think about what's ultimately important. We had a friend when we lived on the North Coast. She'd been unwell for quite some time. She finally went to the doctor and got the diagnosis that she was terminally ill. And she had less than 2 months to live. It worked out to be 6 weeks that she lived. This lady was a Christian. She had a keen faith in Jesus. But I'll never forget the difference that that diagnosis made in her life. She knew that she only had a matter of a few months left to live. And the message about Jesus, a message that she'd always believed, took on a far greater importance in her life. In her 40s, knowing that life will end very shortly. What would you do if you were in that situation? I mean, it's really hard to imagine, I suppose, isn't it? Some people would probably make a list of the DVDs they want to see or the movies they want to see before this life comes to an end. Maybe people would think about a cruise or a holiday that they wanted to go on. Well, this person made a list. She made a list of all of the people that she needed to speak to before she died. And she started out going out and visiting them, having lunch with them, talking with them about what had happened in her life and her diagnosis, and talking to them about her trust in Jesus. That she was confident about facing this end of her life because she knew where she would be for all eternity. As her health declined, she then switched to writing letters or making phone calls. That diagnosis made a big impact on her life. Prior to the diagnosis, I doubt she'd thought too much about her future at all. Might have made a few plans for a holiday, might have been thinking about her superannuation. But after the diagnosis, well, her future was all that she could think about. And she was determined to make friends for eternal life. I think that's what Jesus is talking about in this parable. We should be making friends for eternal life. And don't wait for the catastrophic event. The man in the parable waited to be sacked, my friend. For her, it was this diagnosis. But we need to use what we have in mind with an eye towards heaven. I was in a conversation some time ago with two guys who I know who are Christian men, both executives in big companies here in Australia, both earning rather large sums of money. And it was an interesting conversation because they were talking about their careers and how now was the time they were really going to have to throw themselves into it. If they wanted to make it up those last few rungs in the corporate ladder, they needed to be totally committed to what they were doing. They needed to sacrifice everything else, including family, in order to throw themselves into this business. What stunned me was that they had an eye to the future, I suppose, but just a very short future. I mean, that future didn't go terribly long at all. They certainly weren't making plans with an eye towards eternity. And the disappointing thing was that it sounded a heck of a lot like they were serving money rather than serving God. Now again, don't misunderstand what I'm saying. I'm not saying that you should never be successful in business. It's a question of your priorities. It's a question of the attitude that you have towards these things. See, the day will come when those two men will stand before Jesus, and I doubt Jesus will be terribly interested how far they made it up that corporate ladder. He'll be far more interested in other things. Jesus will be more concerned about how faithful and trustworthy they have been with the things that he has entrusted to them. It's a great expression, isn't it, that one that Jesus uses there in verse 9? I tell you, use worldly wealth to gain friends for yourself so that when it is gone, you will be welcomed into eternal dwellings. Using worldly wealth so that you'll be welcomed into eternal dwellings. That's what Jesus wants us to do. Act with an eye to the future, to our real future. Not the little short-term one, but the one that lasts for all eternity.